Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 145. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at two incredibly different films. First off, from 1962, we have The Intruder, directed by Roger Corman, also known as I Hate Your Guts, Shame and the Strangers, starring William Shatner. And then, just for something totally different, I'm looking at one of the least well-remembered Mel Brooks movies, and that is from 1970, The 12 Chairs, starring Frank Langella and Ron Moody. It's a comedy set in Russia, directed by Mel Brooks, and I hadn't seen it for a long time, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm going to get the contact details and the credits out of the way, and then we'll start talking movies.
Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it.
And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his. Okay, how is everybody? We're about to drive north 800 kilometres to Sydney for my sister's wedding, so I'm recording this one a little bit early. I usually record these things on a weekend during the daytime, and it's now a Tuesday night, so if I sound a little bit different, it's probably because I've been up and working all day. But anyway, so Sydney we're heading to. It's going to be a blast, and I don't expect to watch too many movies over the next week, which is going to be a little bit different for me, but I'll manage somehow. But I'll just give you a bit of an idea about what I have been watching since I last recorded. I did see Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark, the one with Bill Paxton and Adrian Pazdar in it, the vampire flick. I also got Lance Hendrickson in it. It's kind of okay, but there have been so many movies after it which kind of emulated it, that watching it again, it didn't have that kind of freshness that it had back in, I think, about 1987 when it came out. But having said that, it's still an honourable little vampire movie. It's done very well, and Catherine Bigelow's chops as a director are very much in evidence in the flick. I saw one of the lesser Blake Edwards movies recently as well, Sunset, with James Garner and Bruce Willis, about Wyatt Earp meeting Tom Mix and getting involved in shenanigans in Hollywood in the 1920s. It's kind of okay. I don't mind it as much as a lot of other people do. It apparently was nominated for a bunch of Razzie Awards at the time. But I'm not as harsh on it as they are, because I kind of like the idea of movies set in historic Hollywood, particularly in the silent movie era. And rewatching that wasn't too arduous a task for me. I did see a Gerd Oswald movie from the late 1950s, which was kind of interesting. It was a Columbia Pictures movie, and Columbia, of course, doing the kind of low end of the scale movies at the time. It's a black and white film called Screaming Mimi, starring Anita Ekberg and Phil Carey. It's a little bit like Psycho. It's a little bit not like Psycho. It shows how wonderfully inept Anita Ekberg is as an actor, and yet how impressive she was as a presence in movies. If you know what I mean, and you probably do. So I hadn't seen that before, and it's got a little bit of twisted sexuality, and it's got Gypsy Rose Lee playing a lesbian nightclub owner, which is a feature of interest, definitely. It's worth checking out. I'm not sure I'll ever do it on a podcast, but I can kind of recommend it if you're into that kind of B or C grade 1950s psychological drama, murder kind of things. Based on when I just bumped the tape, I love doing that when I'm recording. I also watched Quatermass 2, the second of the Brian Donlevy Quatermass movies from the 1950s. And I think Donlevy's a little bit better in this one, and it's an interesting flick. Little alien spores come down from outer space and start infecting people, and they start building habitats for giant alien blobs on the coast of England. So, yep, that was worth checking out. I didn't mind that one at all, rewatching it. I like the idea of people storming military bases and shooting great big blobby aliens with grenade launchers and all sorts of things like that. So, yeah, it's okay. Nigel Neal again, but I still don't like Don Levy as Quatermass. I really have a bit of a problem with him. I think he's a little bit too harsh and unlikable for the role, even though Quatermass the scientist is a curmudgeon and a bit self-centered in a lot of ways. I think the fact that you've got somebody like Don Levy with all of his baggage in gangster films and things like that playing the role, it doesn't really work. But apart from that, haven't been watching too much. As I said, there hasn't been a lot of time since I recorded last weekend for the last Martian Drive-In podcast. But, yep, so on to the movies. As I said, we're doing The Intruder, the Roger Corman movie, the most unsuccessful Roger Corman movie, according to Roger Corman, a 1962 film starring William Shatner, Frank Maxwell, Gene Cooper, and Beverly Lunsford. And, that one surprised me a little bit. I'd never seen it. It is in public domain. If you go to archive.org, you can download a pretty reasonable copy of it. And there are also copies on YouTube. I'd search around YouTube a little bit and get the one with the best picture value. There are a couple of slightly ropey ones on YouTube, but there is a fairly good one as well. So that's the first of the two movies we're doing. And then The 12 Chairs, a Russian comedy by Mel Brooks. It's based on quite a famous Russian short story and had been filmed a number of times in Russian, but Mel Brooks's version is the only English language version of the story that I've ever been able to find. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies, The Intruder from 1962, starring The Shat. But I should do a little bit of a warning. The N-word is dropped in some of the clips that I play. It is accurate to the movie, but I do realise that it can cause offence to some people, and that's not the intention.
Who are you?
My name's Adam Kramer. Your housekeeper said this would be a good time for us to talk.
Well, what's on your mind?
Quite a bit, sir. I think you'll be interested.
Well, you tell me all about whatever it is you're selling in a letter. Keep on working him, right?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Shipman, I'm not selling anything.
Then what are you after?
A little courtesy, for one thing. Mr. Shipman, I've traveled all the way from Washington, D.C. to talk to you.
Washington, huh?
Yes, sir, D.C.
Well, let's go over here in the shade.
Good. Lovely place you have.
Thank you. Well, now, what is it you want to know?
Well, sir, you see, I represent the Patrick Henry Society. And what we'd like to know is just this, how you stand, whether you're for integration or against it.
Well, that's a stupid question, young man. I'm a Southerner. Sit down.
Thank you.
See, I was born and raised in these parts. So were my folks.
That is, you're against it.
Well, of course I'm against it. What's the matter with you?
Well, I just like to get it straight. You see, sir, our organization agrees with you. We believe this ruling to be one of the greatest wrongs the government has ever perpetrated.
Yeah, it's a shame, all right, but what can we do?
Fight.
We did. We lost. It's a law now.
Whose law? I thought this was a democracy, and I thought a democracy was based on the collective will of the people.
Sure, of course, sure.
And is it the collective will of the people that Negroes should be allowed to mix with whites right under the same roof? Study with them, eat with them, maybe even sleep with them? Is it the collective will of the people that niggers should be allowed to take over the whole world? Because that's what's going to happen, Mr. Shipman.
You think it can be stopped?
With your help, I'm sure of it.
Legally? Start talking, my boy.
Okay, there's a clip from the 1962 Roger Corman-directed movie The Intruder, also known as I Hate Your Guts, Shame, and The Stranger. The story, the book, it's based on a book, actually, by a very interesting writer called Charles Beaumont, who wrote a lot for The Twilight Zone. Charles Beaumont had a really unfortunate life in a lot of ways. He contracted something which may have been Pick's disease or Alzheimer's. They're unsure which one it was. And basically, he died of dementia in his late 30s. In the years before his death, a lot of his friends picked up some of his writing assignments to keep his name in there and to fulfill obligations that he'd made before he became ill. And Beaumont insisted on splitting the money with them 50-50. It's just a horrible thing to happen to quite a fine writer. And in fact, Charles Beaumont, the writer of a number of Twilight Zone episodes as well as this movie, appears as a school teacher in The Intruder, which is really cool. Here's a brief description of the plot from Wikipedia. The story depicts the machinations of a racist named Adam Kramer, portrayed by William Shatner, who arrives in the fictitious small southern town of Caxton in order to incite townspeople to racial violence against the town's black minority and court-ordered school integration. So this is all about those integration and civil rights things from the early 1960s. And it was actually filmed in Missouri. Corman had $90,000, which was mostly the money, his own money, and that of his brother, Gene Corman, the producer. They got a little bit of money from Pathé Labs, but most of the money was their own money. And it took about 40 or 50 years for the movie to actually make its money back. They finally got the last bit of the money only a few years ago, and that, of course, pissed Roger Corman off. But in spite of that, I think it's a good little film. It's 84 minutes long. It's filmed in black and white, and it's in the public domain because in some way the Cormans lost the rights to it. And it's got a fine little cast, too, apart from Shatner, who is good in the cast as Kramer. I really like Shatner in this one, mostly because he's playing a total bastard and doing it quite well. Yes, he is a bit bombastic and over the top, but it's actually in tune with the character. There's an old character actor called Frank Maxwell playing one of the people who stands up against Adam Kramer. Beverly Lunsford plays the daughter of Frank Maxwell's character, whom Adam Kramer seduces. Apart from being a racist kind of rabble-rouser, Kramer also has an eye for the ladies, and he's not only seduces a teenage schoolgirl played by Beverly Lunsford, but he also seduces the wife of one of his neighbours in the boarding house he's in, played by Gene Cooper. And her husband is played by one of the great gruff character actors of the time, Leo Gordon. Now, Leo Gordon, he wrote some things for Corman as well. He he was known as a good actor, but he was also a bit of a writer as well. And Leo Gordon got one of his early roles in Riot and Cell Block 11, the Don Siegel movie. He had a couple of things going for him in that. First off, he was a war veteran, so he was a genuinely tough man. And also, he'd done some time for armed robbery in his youth. And so he knew about prisons and knew about that kind of thing, so he got the role in Riot and Cell Block 11, and a lot of subsequent work as well. And Leo Gordon in this plays incredibly against type. He is really great. There are a couple of scenes he has with Shatner where he really does bring a fantastic presence and sense of menace to the character, even though ultimately the character he plays is not a menacing character. The guy he plays in the movie is a travelling salesman called Sam Griffin, who's kind of over the top. He loves his wife very much. You can tell he's a kind of an ass-slapping kind of good old boy kind of character. And at the start of the movie, when you first see him, when he and his wife vibe meets Kramer. And while I was watching it, I thought he was going to be one of the people that Kramer seduces into being part of the mob that he raises to stop school integration in Caxton. But no, he's not. He's a much more complex character. And the lovely thing about Beaumont's script for this movie, and I don't know whether it was in the book as well, but going by the script, is that people play against type. Frank Maxwell playing a newspaperman in the town. At the start of the film, kind of expresses ambivalence about integration in schools, and he's not sure where he stands on it. He's not sure, you know, he knows it's the law, he's going to obey the law, but he's kind of ambivalent about integrating schools. But as the story progresses and as things get worse in the town, the KKK turn up and do a cross burning, for instance. People are beaten up. The level of violence and the level of nastiness in the town increases. As that happens, Tom McDaniel, the character played by Frank Maxwell, realizes that he's got to make a stand. He's got to do what's right. He's got to write something in the newspaper to combat this pernicious and nasty racism that's being pumped up in the town. There's a lot of underlying racism in the town. A number of characters in the town express kind of an unthinking and not particularly violent racism in what they say. One of the characters being the father-in-law of Tom Daniels, the character. And his wife as well kind of expresses the same ambivalence about integration as he does. And so that kind of beds them into the town. You know, they're not people from the north coming and telling other people what to do. That ambivalence is an important part of the story, an important part of the arc. And while Shatner gets the star role, he gets the kind of over-the-top Elmer Gantry kind of racist role, and he gets all of the best speeches in the movie, and he gets the kind of the standing on the steps of the town hall and inciting people to stop the integration of the schools. He gets all of that kind of stuff, which is fine, and it's the kind of thing that Shatner, as a person, apparently likes. But the really interesting male characters in the movie are Tom McDaniel and Sam Griffin, because they each have an arc and they each play against type. Now, in a simpler story, and in a kind of story that isn't as nuanced as this one, Tom McDaniel, the newspaperman, would have been against racism and for integration right from the start, but not in this one. In this one, there's that kind of path that he has to walk, and that leads him to some very dark and nasty places, and there is some extreme nastiness in this movie. For 1962, there's a real sense of dread and a sense of the uncontrollable hatred of a mob that is portrayed very well. It doesn't pull punches, this movie. It really does go for the jugular when it needs to. Apparently, the filmmakers were chased out of the town because, being in Missouri, it's not too far from the south. And they had to get a last shot of the school, and apparently it was a kind of hit-and-run bit of filming where Roger Corman was in a car with a couple of guys, and they stopped outside the school, filmed what they needed to film as a kind of establishing shot, I think, and then just basically raced out of town with a whole bunch of cars chasing them, which is kind of interesting and kind of shows you how dedicated Corman was to making this film. He really wanted to make a film of some importance about what at the time was a very controversial subject, and put his own money up to have it made. There's a new Blu-ray release of this film, which I haven't seen, but it may well be worth getting, because I think, along with things like Boxcar Bertha and a couple of other films, it really is an important piece of Roger Corman's career. Now, the character I like most in this movie really has to be Sam Griffin, because Leo Gordon, you know, is playing it kind of a little bit broad, but the character is a salesman. He's a travelling salesman, so he knows how to read people and is a great judge of character. It's implicit in the job that he does, and he's the person who really points out to us as an audience that Adam Kramer, the racist rebel-rouser, is, at essence, a weak man. and a coward and really doesn't know what to do once he's kind of incited the mob mentality and incited the mob violence. His purpose from whoever has hired him in Washington, D.C. to come to the town and stop the integration. His job is to stop the integration. His job isn't to start a race riot in a town and to get people killed. And he thinks that he's got the people under control. He's a smooth character. He's a smooth talker. He's at a surface level, likable and approachable and friendly and all that kind of thing. But underneath it, there's this really feral and nasty racism, which Shatner plays kind of interestingly, because there's not really any evidence in the film that he's more than just an operator. He's a hired gun in a sense. He's not really, he doesn't seem to be incredibly dedicated to white power. He seems to want to manipulate people for his own purposes, and he's a kind of really sociopathic character in that way. And Shatner does really well at that. Leaving aside the fact that he's become a punchline at a certain level these days, there was a time in history when William Shatner was a fine actor. He wasn't maybe in the absolute top rank. He wasn't up there with Montgomery Clift at the time and people like that. But he did have chops, and he did have a presence and not really a gravitas, but a magnetism that showed up in this film and really did, before he started becoming more mannered in those pauses in unusual places in sentences and all that kind of shit, before he started playing those kind of stupid games to get a larger chunk of the pie doing Star Trek, he was a fine actor, and you can't really take that away from him. This film does reflect that. But getting back to Sam Griffin, there's a beautiful couple of beautiful scenes with Shatner and Leo Gordon, which really does take this movie out of the ordinary in a lot of ways. Now, Leo Gordon playing Sam Griffin, he knows that Adam Kramer has slept with his wife, and his wife's left. She's run away thinking she's not good enough for her husband. And there's one scene in the hotel room where Kramer's staying with Leo Gordon, which really lifts this film way out of the ordinary. You've got certain expectations in movies. If you see a scene of a man whose wife's been seduced by another man and the confrontation between the two of them, and the man who is wrong pulls out a gun, you expect the movie, you expect the scene to go one way. You expect it to really end in violence, physical violence. And this one doesn't. This one takes it in another direction and really does strengthen the story by doing so. It's a lovely piece of writing by Charles Beaumont, and it's a lovely piece of two-hander acting by Leo Gordon and William Shatner. And there's also another scene right at the very end of the movie, the climax of the movie, where Leo Gordon and Shatner have another scene together. And that plays out differently than our expectations. And this character that we see at the start of the film is an ass-slapping kind of good old boy character, Sam Griffin, becomes something incredibly legendary in that final scene and in the scene in the hotel room with Shatner. Really, Charles Beaumont's writing in this blew me away because it doesn't play to expectations. Now, the other really great scene in this film is the scene where, and this is a slight spoiler, where Tom McDaniel is in hospital and is visited in hospital by his wife. Now, again, the writing in that is incredibly good, and there's a kind of truthfulness to the way Charles Beaumont writes the scene, which impressed me a lot. Now, you go to see a kind of B-movie from the early 1960s, and you expect a certain level of professionalism, a certain level of competence. You don't expect what this movie brings. You don't expect that little extra bits, that little extra twist, the extra character things that kind of shine a light on the characters. And in some cases, as with Kramer, decreases any respect that we had for the character. But with the Sam Griffin and Tom McDaniel characters, you see it increase, and you see the way that this kind of a confrontation changes people, both for the better and for the worse. And I think that in a reasoned drama, you really do need to show that some people get strengthened by going through the flame of this kind of a confrontation, whereas other people just melt and other people give in to their worst instincts. And I think that's the lovely thing about the Charles Beaumont script, is that there's a complexity to it, which is really, really good. Now, there were big studio films at the time that kind of approach racism in various ways. I mean, you've got the Defiant Ones with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, escaping from a chain gang tied to each other by manacles and that kind of thing, where you've got that kind of pressure cooker confrontation of racism. You've got Intruder in the Dust, based on the Faulkner story. You've got a whole bunch of other ones, but this one doesn't gild the lily at all. It shows it dead up front and shows it really honestly. And I like that. I mean, this film has impressed me. And I've been thinking about it in a couple of days since I watched it. And I thought, yeah, I really should do this for the podcast. It really... And the fact that it's free isn't a bad thing either. I mean, you can get a copy for yourself if you want to. I've actually added the Blu-ray version of this to my wish list on Amazon.com, because I really wouldn't mind a copy of it. And, of course, the shame of it is that it didn't make money, because the subject matter and the approach to the subject matter wasn't something that people wanted to see in an entertainment venue at the time. And that's a shame, too, because I think that had it been more successful and had it made money, then it would have encouraged Roger Corman to, while still doing exploitation fare, to maybe occasionally make these kind of movies that go a bit deeper into some controversial subjects, and we may have ended up with an entirely different filmography in 1960s and 1970s Roger Corman films. Not that he always steered away from it. I mean, there are things like Psych Out, which address drug culture, and Boxcar Bertha, Scorsese's movie that he did for Roger Corman, which I've talked about in a previous podcast. So it's not that Roger Corman did shit films after that. But I really think that had The Intruder been a lot more successful, he really would have had a different kind of film approach and would have really done things differently. And that's a bit of a shame, because this is, I'd say it's in my top five Roger Corman movies now. Not because of Shatner particularly, but mostly because of the script. The script is superb. And I think we lost an enormously gifted writer when Charles Beaumont died, and before that when he suffered the deterioration physically and mentally that he did before his death. Really, I can't recommend this movie enough. Don't expect it to be kind of as smooth and polished as a big studio film. It does have a rawness to it, but it was shot a lot on location, and it's... Look, I'll be honest with you. There are racist aspects to the Australian government at the moment. And there is violence against Muslims that has been kind of beaten up by the way our federal government has approached refugee policy and terrorism and other things. They've really kind of incited something they can't control. And there are women in hijabs who are being pushed around on the streets. There's graffiti on mosques. There's all sorts of things like that. And one of the things I thought about while I was watching this film is that Australia's Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, is our own national Adam Kramer, who's inciting things because he wants a certain direction for the country. And there's an aphorism in Australia that when the government changes, the nation changes. And that's proved true to a certain extent up till now, but there's an enormous resistance to the kind of changes that Australia's government is now doing, and the kind of nastiness it's encouraged in certain people. and the racism, the dog whistling to racism, because race is overwhelmingly vote conservatively, that is occurring, whether it's the intention of the government or not. So for me, it's a very timely movie, The Intruder, because it does remind me that you can incite people to a certain level of hatred and vilification of other people, but you never control it. It's like taking a pickaxe to a dam. You might be able to punch through it, but you're not going to control what comes out. So that's about it for The Intruder. I really did like it, and again, I recommend it to for people to check out. So I'm going to take a break now. I'm going to get back a lot lighter, a lot more fun, and while not a perfect film, it's a Mel Brooks movie that I'm fond of, The 12 Chairs from 1970, starring Frank Langella and Ron Moody.
Attention! Ladies and gentlemen, attention! A comrade, a citizen, a fellow human being cries out for our attention! Epilepsy, my friends! Epilepsy! The same disease that struck down our own beloved Dostoevsky. God knows what genius, what great works of art may be trapped in the mind of this poor, wretched soul.
This poor man.
Roll your eyes.
Yes, give. Give, so that this quivering, shivering, helpless victim can receive desperately needed medical attention.
Give, please. Give. Thank you. Please
give. That was Frank Langella touting up some business in the 1970 Mel Brooks film, The 12 Chairs. The movie is based on a classic Russian satirical novel by a couple of guys called Ilf and Petrov, which was published in 1928. The story is really simple in essence. In the Soviet Union in 1927, a former member of the nobility, whose name is Vorobyanov, works as a desk clerk. His mother-in-law reveals on her deathbed that her family jewels have been hidden from the Bolsheviks and one of 12 chairs from the family's dining room set. These chairs, along with all other personal property, have been taken away by the communists after the Russian Revolution. He becomes a treasure hunter, and after the smooth operator and con man, Ostap Bender, played by Frank Langella, Vorobyanov is played by Ron Moody, forces Vorobyanov to partner with him. They set off to track down the chairs. So that's basically the story. And don't expect me to say Vorobyanov too many times during the recording of this podcast, because it is a bit of a gobful. There have been a lot of adaptations of The 12 Chairs, and I'm moving bits of paper around. Sorry for the noise. There was a cinema adaptation in a joint Polish-Czech film in 1933. And I'm getting all of this from Wikipedia. And a lot of the adaptations after that, it says here, were based more on the film than on the novel itself. There was a version in Nazi Germany in 1938 called Dresden Stuhl, 13 chairs, I think. And I apologize to Armin if I pronounced that badly. The authors of the novel in that version remained uncredited, probably because Ilf, one of the writers, was of Jewish origins. The book also inspired a 1936 film that I've seen called Keep Your Seats, Please, starring George Formby, and the action takes place in Britain, and that one involves 7 chairs and not 12 chairs.
Turned out nice again, hasn't it?
Jack Benny and Fred Allen did a version of it in 1945 called It's in the Bag. And there was a 1957 Brazilian version of it called 13 Chairs, just to up the ante a little bit. And there's a 1962 Cuban version, Las Doce Silas, which is kind of weird. Then Mel Brooks did a version. And there was a film called The 13 Chairs starring Sharon Tate in 1969. And there was a miniseries in Russia in 1976 and a film in 1971. So this thing's been told a lot. Now, I do have to be honest, the version that I saw, the Mel Brooks version, has a sanitized ending. And I'm going to do a spoiler on the ending of the novel. So if you don't want to know the ending of a 1928 Russian novel, Skip forward about 30 seconds and all will be well. In the novel, Vorobyanov kills Bender and then goes insane, which for me is a good way to end a satirical novel. I mean, you've got to leave them laughing, and that's what happens. But the Mel Brooks version doesn't end like that because it's a Mel Brooks movie. It's an American movie of 1970s, and it's supposedly a comedy, and it is a comedy. But so having Ron Moody bash out Frank Langella's brains and then go totally bugfuck is not really going to play well, so they change the ending. Allowing that, it's a lot of fun. It's kind of a mashup in a sense between the over-the-top tumbling of Mel Brooks and the kind of slapstick kind of Mel Brooksian comedy, and some really nice stuff of a little more depth, which is kind of makes it neither fish nor fowl. There's a whole subplot with a very unscrupulous Russian Orthodox priest played by Dom DeLuise, who finds out about the chairs, shaves his beard, and starts chasing them. Now, Bender, Frank Langella's character, sends him off on a wild goose chase into Siberia. And there's lots of bits and pieces there with Dom DeLuise mugging and doing his kind of comedy, chasing down the wrong set of chairs and basically not being a very happy camper at all. I don't know how much of that was done to flesh out the story and to give it a different angle rather than just concentrating on the Vorobyanov and Bender. But it's not really a distraction, but it is kind of a tonal shift in the movie to have those scenes with Dom DeLuise in there. It isn't a perfect film, I'll be honest about that, but I do like it. And I like Frank Langella. Now, people remember Frank Langella mostly for playing older guys and for being a mean bastard and playing any number of villains in everything from Masters of the Universe onwards. But this is young Frank Langella. Now, Frank Langella did a TV adaptation of The Mark of Zorro in the early 1970s and played Zorro really well. And this is the kind of dashing, romantic, charismatic Frank Langella from his younger days before the birthdays caught up on him and that horrible, nasty, evil and totally unnecessary genetic damage we know as aging affected him. Langella is really good in this film. He's kind of smart, witty, nasty, romantic. People, of course, also saw him do his Dracula in the 1970s. So this is a kind of pre-Dracula Frank Langella doing a really nice little job there. Ron Moody, a little less so. Ron Moody is never... he played Fagin in Oliver, you might remember. He's never an actor who managed to project any kind of warmth or sympathy. He's a very mannered kind of actor. And I think he may have played well on the stage. In fact, he probably did doing Oliver for a long time. But I don't think he and Langella make a particularly fantastic partnership, even though you can definitely see Frank Langella doing the heavy lifting from his side of things. I'm trying to think who would be better. Alec Guinness would have played it very well if Alec Guinness had been available, and he probably was. He would have made a really good Vorobyanov. Ron Moody, not so much. The reason I'm saying Alec Guinness would have been interesting in it is if you go back and see him in things like The Horse's Mouth, he would have been a fantastic Vorobyanov. And that's getting easier to say too, by the way, Vorobyanov. Once you do it 15 or 20 times, it does roll off the tongue a little bit better than it would have previously. But Mel Brooks turns up in this one as well. Mel Brooks ends up playing a former servant of Vorobyanov, who's still locked into that headspace of being an obsequious servant. And yes, he's kind of playing a very borscht belt broad and that kind of thing. And maybe he only appears at the start of the film too, so maybe the thinking when they were making the film was get Mel Brooks in, get him to do all of the silly stuff and drag people into the story, which then goes off in a different direction. So having Mel Brooks in there being totally silly kind of is an easy in. Now, Mel Brooks was on a roll at this stage. He got an Academy Award in 1968 for doing The Producers. And so his next project was this one, which was not at all a success. I think Brooks kind of wanted to obviously he did have a personal interest in the project, but I think maybe he didn't let go of the outrageous silliness of The Producers when he made it, which is the reason why there are the bits with Dom DeLuise in there and his little bits at the start. I think that had he had a little more faith in the material, it would have gone really well. Now, the locations on this one are quite impressive too. Brooks filmed it in Yugoslavia, which has got the right kind of landscape and the right kind of people's faces to make this work. And I'm just trying to kind of work through the characters in this film, because there's not one of them that's a really nice person. You've got Tikhon, the servant played by Mel Brooks, who's locked into being a slave in a sense. You've got Vorobyanov, who's totally greedy. Bender, who's totally greedy. Father Fyodor, played by Dom DeLuise, who's totally greedy. And all of them are kind of nasty and greedy and shitty characters. Now, I just read the review of this by Roger Ebert, and as often happens with movies after I read reviews by Roger Ebert, I look at it a slightly different way now. And one of the things Ebert says that's really interesting is that these cynical characters, and remember, Brooks did change the ending, but I think I understand why, having read that review, Mel Brooks did change the ending for this movie. Brooks changed the ending, but what it is everybody in the movie, the main characters of the movie, are greedy shits. There's no two ways about it. But by the end of the movie, two of them have found friendship and acceptance of their lot in life. And that's a kind of an interesting arc, to go from being a total shit, not to being a virtuous person, not to being a nice person, not to being a person of honour, but to be a person who accepts life and who accepts things and who realises, yeah, I may never be rich, but on the other hand, yeah, I'm still alive. That kind of humanitarian fatalism is an interesting place to be. And I don't usually read reviews of movies I review on Paleo Cinema Podcast, but in this case it really does add to what I'm doing, and it's made me reflect a little bit more on it. I still think that Dom DeLuise is a little plays it a bit too large for the kind of movie that this is trying to be. But I like Brooks for trying this film. I really think it's a good thing to do, because he did The Producers, which was hilariously funny and hilariously transgressive at the time. Not many people were doing musicals about Hitler in 1968, but Brooks did and made it a success and forced it down people's throats, and they loved it. But to then go to an obscure, from a Western point of view, Russian story about greedy bastards, even though it had been done a number of times before in anglophonic movies, is an interesting choice there. I mean, have a look at, just imagine somebody like Mel Brooks now, Judd Apatow or somebody like that. Judd Apatow has a great success with 40-Year-Old Virgin, that kind of thing, and still makes the same sort of kind of movie set in the same sort of kind of places since then. He's kind of locked into a certain milieu at the moment, whereas Mel Brooks goes from Broadway to Russia and then to the West and then to other places. He really did kind of move it around a little bit and try out different things, and that's probably not a bad career arc for somebody with an initial success in comedy to go, to kind of do something different. Even though, as this one was, it's not an entirely successful film, in the arc of a career, it's a nice place to be. It's a nice little piece of that, where he left Hollywood, went to Yugoslavia, made a movie, did some of the interiors in England, and made it work. This isn't ever going to be one of my favourite movies of all time by any means. And one of the things about Mel Brooks that makes him such an interesting person is that he's always been deeper than the characters he played in movies and the persona he often put on when being interviewed and things like that, that kind of borscht belt Jewish comedy thing. He actually produced a lot of movies as well. 84 Charing Cross Road, The Elephant Man was a movie he produced. So along with that kind of broad Jewish comedy kind of thing, Mel Brooks is also an intelligent guy and a well-read guy, and who did produce a number of films that he didn't star in, but that are of great value and are among the best ever made in some ways. So, I mean, it's nice to see that Mel Brooks is still around. There's a recent documentary where he was interviewed, and there was an overview of his career, which was kind of fun. And he's still doing shtick, and he's still who he is. I mean, this guy went from basically mind-clearing during World War II to writing comedy for Sid Caesar and people like that, to making comedy albums, to doing some stuff on TV. Get Smart was one of his things with Buck Henry. And then in his 40s, starting to do things like The Producers and Blazing Saddles, The 12 Chairs, High Anxiety, Silent Movie, all of those kind of things are really... Well, I like Mel Brooks, and when he finally does step on the rainbow, I'm going to be quite sad about it, because I think that he's made literally billions of people laugh, even if it's only at the fart jokes in Blazing Saddles. Every time even if I just mention the fart jokes in Blazing Saddles to Sally, she'll laugh about it. And that's probably not a bad legacy for anybody in comedy to have. It's just a mention of one of the scenes in one of your movies makes people laugh. Then it's a great thing. And 12 Chairs, to be honest with you, what I might do is I might leave it for a year and then I might rewatch it again. I think it's because I hadn't seen it in about 25 years, maybe. It's probably one of those films that I'd get some value from rewatching it in 12 months' time. And I may even mention that I rewatched it on the podcast and just see whether my opinions of it changed. I still think that there's a tonal problem with the Domino Louise scenes. Other people may disagree. And I think Ron Moody is not the ideal choice for Vorobyanov. See, it gets easier to say. But this was Langella's first movie role as well, and I think he's great in it. He was a stage actor, and he does bring that kind of presence to things. And I always did like Langella. I've got a copy of Robot and Frank at one of the recent movies he did. I may well end up doing that for Martian Drive-In Podcast if it turns out to be any good. I picked up a Blu-ray of it along with a whole bunch of other ones, and I just haven't had the time to sit down and watch it, but I think I will now that I've watched The 12 Chairs. And that's one of the other things about this gig and this self-imposed Sisyphean task of podcasting about movies, is that watching one movie with an actor, it leads you to another one and another one. I mean, saw The Trap with Lee J. Cobb playing the villain in it. And now I'm looking for movies that I haven't seen before that have Lee J. Cobb in them, because he was really interesting in that. And that's the way it is. You kind of skipping across this river on little stones of things that pique your interest, and little bits from actors and directors and even people who do music film composers. Sorry, I'm doing this early in the morning and I'm still one coffee short of a maximum load at the moment. Movie composers. I mean, the fact that I liked David Raxon's music in Laura and in The Bad and the Beautiful led me on to seeing other obscure little movies like Sylvia, a movie that I like with Carol Baker and George Maharis in it, which is kind of a B picture from the 1960s. So one thing leads to another, to another, to another. And that's one of the lovely things about this, that skipping between things based on fairly obscure choices and fairly obscure people who are part of a particular film. So I'm definitely going to check out Robot and Frank. As I said before, I'm not probably going to be able to watch a movie for the next 7 or 8 days. And if I do, there won't be many of them. But when I get back, I've got a few days off still before I go back to work. So I may cram a few of those movies like that I've got copies of, but I haven't really been able to do anything with. So the question for this episode is, what snack food should I have while I'm watching my backlog of movies when I get back from Sydney? Now, there've got to be snacks I can get in Australia, so I don't want to hear anything about stuff that from overseas that I can't get hold of. But perfect snack foods for watching movies. Now, drinks I can take care of myself. If I feel like a beer, I'll have a beer. Mostly I'll be down in espressos and mineral water. But what's a really good snack food for watching films with? So just email me, cultguru@gmail.com, and let me know what you think about that. Or do it on the Book of Faces as well. There's not much else to say about The 12 Chairs. I'm thinking about it. The longer I think about it, the more I like it. Let's put it that way. It's a weird little movie for that reason. And even though I can see those flaws in it, you know, the weakness of Dom DeLuise in there and the changed ending and Mel Brooks's mugging and silliness in there, I think that, it's better than I expected it to be, and it's better than It's better than I thought it was immediately after I watched the film. And that's a kind of weird thing. But anyway, I'm going to leave that film now. And when I get back from playing the really interesting and fun Mel Brooks theme song to The 12 Chairs, I've got a bit of feedback for us.
That was splendid. Then he died the day he planned. Go and spend it shouting, live while you're alive. No one will survive. Life is sorrow. Here today and gone tomorrow. Live while you're alive. No one will survive. There's no guarantee. Oh, for the best. Expect the worst.
That was Hope for the Best, Expect the Worst, which pretty much is a philosophy of The 12 Chairs. Now, I got a little bit of feedback. Our good friend Morris from Love That Album, he and I had a bit of a chat online, and I've kind of got a bit of a transcription here. Morris was a person who recommended To Be or Not to Be for the podcast, so I got a little tiny bit of feedback about that. Morris says, lovely discussion about To Be or Not to Be. Terry, I agree that it took guts to make a film like that during the war. The Three Stooges, however, really flipped the bird with their short "You Nazi Spy," before anyone in Hollywood really had the guts to do something like that. And I did look up a little bit about "You Nazi Spy" with the Three Stooges, and sure enough, they did. Given the fact that they were three Jewish guys, Mo Howard, his brother, Curly, whose name I forget, and Larry Fine, they did do it. And that's the interesting thing about comedy. One of the great things about comedy is that it can slip in the knife while people are looking in another direction, and that's why it's amongst the most transgressive of movie genres. It really can kick you in the balls while you're looking at the pie being thrown in someone else's face. And for all of the criticism that you get for the Three Stooges, the violence of their kind of comedy and that kind of thing, and the broadness that they brought even to that comedy short, they at least made the effort and did what they could within the genre they work in to mock the Germans and the German war machine and the Nazis, and all credit to them and Columbia Pictures, who put out the Three Stooges shorts, for doing that. It's not going to win a war or anything like that, but it is part of that cultural background that wins wars. Now, I'm not going to talk about winning wars in the 21st century, because that's an incredibly complex matter. It doesn't have the simplicity of a 1940s war. But that's pretty much it this time around. I'm sorry this is a bit of a short podcast, but as I said, I'm recording this early before heading up to Sydney. I will be back in a week with another Martian Drive-In podcast, and in a fortnight with another Paleo Cinema podcast. And in the meantime, keep watching good films. Look after yourselves. Be kind to each other. Don't believe the hype. And hug the people you love. And I'll leave you with a last little bit of music, being that Lancashire lad, George Formby, with Turned Out Nice Again. See you later.
Turned out nice again, hasn't it? Summer, autumn, winter, so the seasons go. Sometimes we get them all at once with a little rain or snow. The sun for long, it doesn't shine, it's either wet or else it's fine. Last night I said when I went to bed, it's turned out nice again. In this hotel I'll sleep well, it's turned out nice again. A sweet young bride then popped inside, turned down the counterpane. She shouted, ooh, I said, Pete Boo, it's turned out nice again. Said Mrs. Rouse at Seaview House, it's turned out nice again. The joint is through, but as a stew, it's turned out nice again. A fork she stuck into the duck, it seemed to be in pain. I said, here goes for the parson's nose, it's turned out nice again. Upon your girl you start to be polite. Though it's raining cats and dogs, you say it's a lovely night tonight. With her you start to bill and coo. The glass is falling and she is too. Last washing day I heard them say it's turned out nice again. For the bits of hose and these and those, it's turned out nice again. To Mrs. James or what's her name's, I said you can't complain. It's the same pair, dear, that you wore last year. They've turned out nice again. Said Dr. Wright to me last night, it's turned out nice again. It's plain to tell, the wife's doing well. It's turned out nice again. I said to the nurse, tell me the worst. She said, you will feel vain. This time it's quads. I said, ye gods, it's turned out nice again.